Random House Audiobooks presents Of Love and Other Demons by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Read for you by Natasha Richardson.
Of Love and Other Demons. October 26, 1949 was not a day filled with important news. Maestro Clemente Manuel Zabala, editor-in-chief of the newspaper where I learned the essentials of being a reporter, concluded our morning meeting with two or three routine suggestions. He did not assign a specific story to any writer. A few minutes later, he was informed by telephone that the burial crypts of the old convent of Santa Clara were being emptied, and with few allusions he said to me, "Stop by there and see if you can come up with anything." The historic convent of the Clarissan nuns, which had been turned into a hospital a century earlier, was to be sold and a 5-star hotel built in its place. The gradual collapse of the roof had left its beautiful chapel exposed to the elements, but 3 generations of bishops, abbesses, and other eminent personages were still buried there. The first step was to empty the crypts, transfer the remains to anyone who claimed them, and bury the rest in a common grave. I was surprised by the crudeness of the procedure. Laborers opened the tombs with pickaxes and hoes, took out the rotting coffins, which broke apart with the simple act of moving them, and separated bones from the jumble of dust, shreds of clothing, and desiccated hair. The more illustrious the dead, the more arduous the labor. Because the workers had to rummage through the remains and sift the debris with great care in order to retrieve precious stones and articles of gold and silver. The foreman copied the information that was on each stone into a notebook, arranged the bones into distinct piles, and placed a sheet of paper with a name on top of every mound to keep them all separate. And so the first thing I saw when I entered the temple was a long line of stacked bones, heated by the savage October sun pouring in through the holes in the roof, and with no more identity than a name scrawled in pencil on a piece of paper. Almost half a century later, I can still feel the confusion produced in me by that terrible testimony to the devastating passage of the years. There, among many others, were a viceroy of Peru and his secret lover, Don Toribio de Cáceres y Virtudes, bishop of this diocese, several of the convent's abbesses, including Mother Josefa Miranda, and the Bachelor of Arts, Don Cristóbal de Eraso, who devoted half his life to building the coffered ceilings. One crypt was sealed with the stone of the second Marquis de Casalduero, Don Ignacio de El Faro y Dueñas. But when it was opened, they found it empty. It had never been used. The remains of his marquesa, however, Doña Olaya de Mendoza, had their own stone in the adjacent crypt. The foreman attached no importance to this. It was not unusual for an American-born aristocrat to have prepared his own tomb and be buried in another. The surprise lay in the third niche of the high altar, on the side where the Gospels were kept. The stone shattered at the first blow of the pickaxe, and a stream of living hair, the intense color of copper, spilled out of the crypt. The foreman, with the help of the laborers, attempted to uncover all the hair, and the more of it they brought out, the longer and more abundant it seemed, until at last the final strands appeared still attached to the skull of a young girl. Nothing else remained in the niche except a few small scattered bones, and on the dressed stone eaten away by saltpeter, only a given name with no surnames was legible. Sierva María de Todos los Ángeles. Spread out on the floor, the splendid hair measured 22 meters, 11 centimeters. The impassive foreman explained that human hair grew a centimeter a month after death, and 22 meters seemed a good average for 200 years. I, on the other hand, did not think it so trivial a matter. For when I was a boy, my grandmother had told me the legend of a little 12-year-old marquesa with hair that trailed behind her like a bridal train, who had died of rabies caused by a dog bite and was venerated in the towns along the Caribbean coast for the many miracles she had performed. The idea that the tomb might be hers was my news item for the day and the origin of this book. Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Cartagena de Indias, 1994. An ash-grey dog with a white blaze on its forehead burst onto the rough terrain of the market on the first Sunday in December, knocked down tables of fried food, overturned Indian stalls and lottery kiosks, and bit four people who happened to cross its path. Three of them were black slaves. The fourth, Sierva María de Todos los Ángeles, the only child of the Marquis de Casalduero, had come there with a mulatta servant to buy a string of bells for the celebration of her 12th birthday. They had been instructed not to go beyond the arcade of the merchants, but the maid ventured as far as the drawbridge in the slum of Gethsemane, attracted by the crowd at the slaver's port where a shipment of blacks from Guinea was being sold at discount. For the past week, a ship belonging to the Compañía Gaditana de Negros had been awaited with dismay because of an unexplainable series of deaths on board. In an attempt at concealment, the unweighted corpses were thrown into the water. The tide brought them to the surface and washed the bodies, disfigured by swelling and a strange magenta colouring, up on the beach. The vessel lay anchored outside the bay, for everyone feared an outbreak of some African plague until it was verified that the cause of death was food poisoning. At the time the dog ran through the market, the surviving cargo had already been sold at reduced prices on account of poor health, and the owners were attempting to compensate for the loss with a single article worth all the rest. An Abyssinian female, almost 2 meters tall, who was smeared with cane molasses instead of the usual commercial oil, and whose beauty was so unsettling it seemed untrue. She had a slender nose, a rounded skull, slanted eyes, all her teeth, and the equivocal bearing of a Roman gladiator. She had not been branded in the slave pen, and they did not call out her age and the state of her health. Instead, she was put on sale for the simple fact of her beauty. The price the governor paid, without bargaining and in cash, was her weight in gold. It was a common occurrence for a stray dog to bite people as it chased after cats or fought turkey buzzards for the carrion in the streets, and it was even more common during the times of prosperity and crowds when the galleon fleet stopped on its way to the Portobello fair. No one lost sleep over 4 or 5 dog bites in a single day, least of all over an almost invisible wound like the one on Sierva Maria's left ankle, and therefore the maid was not alarmed. She treated the bite herself with lemon and sulphur and washed the blood stain from the girl's petticoats, and no one gave a thought to anything but the festivities for her 12th birthday. Earlier that morning, Bernarda Cabrera, the girl's mother and the untitled spouse of the Marquis de Casalduero, had taken a dramatic purge, 7 grains of antimony in a glass of sugared rose water. She had been an untamed mestiza of the so-called shopkeeper aristocracy. Seductive, rapacious, brazen, with a hunger in her womb that could have satisfied an entire barracks. In a few short years, however, she had been erased from the world by her abuse of fermented honey and cacao tablets. Her gypsy eyes were extinguished and her wits dulled. She shat blood and vomited bile. Her siren's body became as bloated and coppery as a 3-day-old corpse, and she broke wind in pestilential explosions that startled the mastiffs. She almost never left her bedroom, and when she did, she was nude, or wearing a silk tunic with nothing underneath, which made her seem more naked than if she wore nothing at all. She had already moved her bowels 7 times when the maid who accompanied Sierva Maria returned and told her nothing about the dog bite. She did, however, comment on the scandal at the port caused by the sale of the slave woman. "If she's as beautiful as you claim, she might be Abyssinian," said Bernarda. But even if she were the Queen of Sheba, it did not seem possible that anyone would pay her weight in gold. They must have meant in weighed gold pesos, she said. No, as much gold as the black woman weighs, the maid explained. A slave 2 meters tall weighs at least 120 pounds, said Bernarda. And no woman, white or black, is worth 120 pounds of gold unless she shits diamonds. No one had been more astute than Bernarda in the slave trade, and she knew that if the governor had bought the Abyssinian, it could not be for something as sublime as serving in his kitchen. Just then she heard the first hornpipes and firecrackers of a fiesta, followed by the furious barking of the mastiffs in their cages. She went out to the orange grove to see what it could be. Don Ignacio de Alfaro y Dueñas, the second Marquis de Casalduero and the Lord of Darien, had also heard the music from his siesta hammock hanging between 2 orange trees in the grove. He was a funereal, effeminate man, as pale as a lily because the bats drained his blood while he slept. He wore a Bedouin jellaba in the house and a Toledan beretta that increased his forlorn appearance. When he saw his wife as naked as the day God brought her into the world, he anticipated her question and asked, "What music is that?" "I don't know," she said. "What's the date?" The Marquis did not know. He really must have felt quite puzzled to ask his wife anything, and she must have felt complete relief from her bilious attack to reply with no sarcasm. He had sat up in the hammock, intrigued, when the firecrackers exploded again. "Good Lord," he exclaimed, "can it be that date already?" The house adjoined the Divina Pastora Asylum for Female Lunatics. Agitated by the music and fireworks, the patients had appeared on the terrace that overlooked the orange grove, and they celebrated each explosion with ovations. The Marquis called up to them, asking where the fiesta was, and they cleared away his doubts. It was December 7th, the feast of San Ambrose the Bishop, and the music and fireworks thundering in the slaves' courtyard were in honor of Sierra Maria. The Marquis slapped his forehead. "Of course," he said. "How old is she?" 12, replied Bernarda. "Only 12, he said, lying down again in the hammock. "How slow life is." The house had been the pride of the city until the beginning of the century. Now it was a melancholy ruin, and the large empty spaces and the many objects out of place made it seem as if the occupants were in the process of moving. The drawing rooms had kept their checkerboard marble floors and teardrop chandeliers draped in cobwebs. The rooms still in use were cool in any weather because of their thick masonry walls and many years of enclosure, and even more because of the December breezes that came whistling through the cracks. Everything was saturated with the oppressive damp of neglect and gloom. All that remained of the seigneurial dignities of the first Marquis were the fine hunting mastiffs that guarded the knights. The resounding courtyard of the slaves, where Sierra Maria's birthday was being celebrated, had been another city within the city in the time of the first Marquis. This continued under his heir for as long as the illicit traffic in slaves and flour, directed in secret by Bernarda from the Maate's sugar plantation, had lasted. Now all that splendor was a thing of the past. Bernarda had been extinguished by her insatiable vices, and the slave yard reduced to 2 wooden shacks with roofs of bitter palm, where the last scraps of greatness had already been consumed. Dominga de Adviento, a formidable black woman who ruled the house with an iron fist until the night before her death, was the link between these 2 worlds. Tall and bony, and possessed of an almost clairvoyant intelligence, it was she who had reared Sierra Maria. Dominga de Adviento became a Catholic without renouncing her Yoruban beliefs, and she practiced both religions at the same time and at random. Her soul was healthy and at peace, she said, because what she did not find in one faith was there in the other. She was also the only human being with the authority to mediate between the Marquis and his wife, and they both accommodated her. Only she could drive the slaves out with a broom when she discovered them in the vacant rooms committing calamitous acts of sodomy or fornicating with bartered women. but after she died, they would flee the shacks to escape the midday heat and stretch out on the floor in every corner, or scrape the crust out of the rice pots and eat it, or play with the makuko and the tarabija in the cool corridors. In that oppressive world where no one was free, Sierva Maria was. She alone, and there alone. And so that was where her birthday was celebrated, in her true home with her true family. In the midst of so much music, it was difficult to imagine dancing more silent than that of the Marquis's slaves and a few blacks from other distinguished households, who brought whatever they could. The girl displayed just who she was. She could dance with more grace and fire than the Africans, sing in voices different from her own in the various languages of Africa, agitate the birds and animals when she imitated their voices. By order of Dominga de Adviento, the younger slave girls would blacken her face with soot. They hung Santeria necklaces over her baptism scapula and looked after her hair, which had never been cut and would have interfered with her walking if they had not braided it into loops every day. She had begun to blossom under a combination of contradictory influences. She inherited very little from her mother. She had her father's thin body, however, and his irremediable shyness, pale skin, eyes of taciturn blue, and the pure copper of her radiant hair. Her movements were so stealthy that she seemed an invisible creature. Frightened by her strange nature, her mother had hung a cowbell around the girl's wrist so she would not lose track of her in the shadows of the house. 2 days after the fiesta, the maid mentioned in passing to Bernarda that a dog had bitten Sierva Maria. Bernarda thought about it as she took her sixth hot bath of the day with perfumed soaps before going to bed, and by the time she returned to her room she had forgotten it. She did not remember it again until the following night, when the mastiffs barked until dawn for no reason, and she was afraid they had rabies. Then she took a candlestick to the shacks in the courtyard and found Sierva Maria asleep in the hammock of Indian royal palm she had inherited from Dominga de Adviento. Since the maid had not told her where the bite was located, Bernarda raised the girl's chemise and examined her inch by inch, using the light to follow the penitential braid that curled around her body like a lion's tail. At last she found it, a little break in the skin on her left ankle, with a scab of dried blood and some almost invisible abrasions on the heel. Cases of rabies were neither limited nor insignificant in the history of the city. The most notorious was that of a street peddler who plied his trade with a trained monkey whose actions were almost indistinguishable from those of humans. The animal contracted rabies during the naval siege by the English, bit its owner on the face, and escaped to the nearby hills. The unfortunate man was clubbed to death while suffering fearful hallucinations, which mothers still sang about many years later in popular ballads meant to frighten children. Before 2 weeks had passed, a horde of satanic macaque monkeys descended from the hills in the full light of day. They devastated pigsties and henhouses, and then, howling and choking on their own frothing blood, burst into the cathedral during a Te Deum celebrating the defeat of the English fleet. Yet the most terrible dramas, however, did not pass into the annals of history, for they occurred among the population of blacks, who spirited away the victims to cure them by African magic in the settlements of runaway slaves. Despite so many dreadful portents, no one, white, black, or Indian, even gave a thought to rabies or any other disease that was slow to incubate, until the first irreparable symptoms made their appearance. Bernarda Cabrera proceeded according to the same criterion. She thought that the gossip of slaves travelled faster and farther than the inventions of Christians, and that even a simple dog bite might damage the family's honour. She was so certain of her reasoning that she did not mention the matter to her husband, or think about it again until the following Sunday, when the maid went to the market alone and saw the carcass of a dog that had been hung from an almond tree to let everyone know it had died of rabies. One glance was all she needed to recognize the blaze on the forehead and the ash-gray coat of the dog that had bitten Sierva Maria. But Bernarda was not concerned when she heard the news. There was no reason to be. The wound was dry, and not even a trace of the abrasions remained. December had begun with foul weather, but soon recovered its amethyst afternoons and nights of antic breezes. Christmas was more joyous than in other years because of the good news from Spain, but the city was not what it had once been. The principal slave market had been moved to Havana, and the miners and ranchers in these kingdoms of Tierra Firma preferred to buy contraband labor at lower prices in the English Antilles. And so there were two cities, one busy and crowded for the 6 months the galleons remained in the port, and the other that drowsed for the rest of the year as it waited for them to return. Nothing more was known about those who had been bitten until the beginning of January, when a vagabond Indian woman called Sagunta knocked on the marquis's door at the sacred hour of siesta. She was very old, and she walked barefoot in the full sun, leaning on a staff of careto wood and wrapped from head to toe in a white sheet. She was notorious for being a mender of maidenheads and an abortionist, although this was balanced by her admirable reputation for knowing Indian secrets that could heal the incurable. The Marquis stood in the entranceway and received her with great reluctance, and it took him some time to understand what she wanted, for she was a woman who favored slow and intricate circumlocutions. She made so many twists and turns in order to say anything that the Marquis lost patience. "Whatever it is, just tell me with no more Latinizing," he said. "We are threatened by a plague of rabies," said Sagunta. "And I am the only one who has the keys of St. Hubert, protector of hunters and healer of the rabid." "I see no reason for a plague," said the Marquis. "As far as I know, no comets or eclipses have been forecast, and our sins are not great enough for God to be concerned with us." Sagunta informed him that there would be a total eclipse of the sun in March, and gave him a complete account of all those bitten on the first Sunday in December. Two had disappeared, no doubt spirited away by their people to try to cure them with magic, and a third had died of rabies by the second week. A fourth victim, not bitten but only spattered by the dog's spittle, lay dying in the Amor de Dios hospital. The chief constable had ordered 100 stray dogs poisoned so far this month. In another week, not one would be left alive on the streets. "Be that as it may, I do not know what any of this has to do with me," said the Marquis, "least of all at so irregular an hour." "Your daughter was the first to be bitten," said Sagunta. The Marquis responded with great conviction. "If that were true, I would have been the first to know." He believed the girl was well, and it did not seem possible that something so serious could have happened to her without his knowledge. And therefore he considered the visit concluded and went back to finish his siesta. That afternoon, however, he looked for Sierra Maria in the servants' courtyards. She was helping to skin rabbits, and her face was painted black, her feet were bare, and her head was wrapped in the red turban used by slave women. He asked her if she had been bitten by a dog, and the answer was a categorical no. But that night Bernarda confirmed it was true. The Marquis was bewildered and asked, "Then why does Sierra deny it?" "Because she wouldn't tell the truth even by mistake," said Bernarda. "Then it is necessary to take action," said the Marquis, "because the dog had rabies." "No," said Bernarda. "The dog must have died because it bit her. This happened in December, and the little hussy is like a rose." They both continued to be mindful of the growing rumors regarding the seriousness of the plague, and against their own wishes were forced to speak again about questions of common interest, as they had in the days when they hated each other less. For him, the matter was clear. He always believed he loved his daughter, but the fear of rabies obliged the Marquis to admit to himself that this was a lie for the sake of convenience. Bernarda, on the other hand, did not even ask herself the question, for she knew very well she did not love the girl, and the girl did not love her, and both things seemed fitting. A good part of the hatred each of them felt for Sierra Maria was caused by the other's qualities in her. Nevertheless, to preserve her honor, Bernarda was prepared to play out the farce of shedding tears and mourning like a grief-stricken mother, on the condition that the girl's death have a seemly cause. It doesn't matter what, she specified, as long as it's not a dog's disease. At that moment, as if in a blinding flash from heaven, the Marquis understood the meaning of his life. The girl is not going to die, he said with determination. But if she must die, it shall be of whatever God wills. On Tuesday he went to the Amor de Dios Hospital on San Lázaro Hill to see the rabies victim Sagunta had mentioned to him. He was not aware that his carriage with its mortuary crepe would be viewed as yet another symptom of incubating disaster, because for many years he had not left his house except on great occasions, and for many more years there had been no occasions greater than calamitous ones. The city lay submerged in its centuries-long torpor, but there were no lack of observers to glimpse the gaunt face and elusive eyes of the tentative nobleman in mourning taffetas as his carriage left the walled district and drove through the countryside to San Lázaro Hill. At the hospital, the lepers lying on the brick floors saw him walk in with his dead man's gait, and they barred his way to beg for alms. In the pavilion that housed raving lunatics, he found the rabies victim tied to a pillar. He was an old mulatto with a beard and hair like cotton. By now, half his body was paralyzed, but the disease had endowed the other half with so much strength that he had to be tied to keep him from smashing himself to pieces against the walls. His story left no doubt. He had been attacked by the same ash-colored dog with the white blaze that had bitten Sierra Maria. In fact, only the animal's spittle had touched him. But that was on a chronic ulcer on his calf, not healthy skin. This detail was not enough to reassure the Marquis, who left the hospital horrified by the sight of the dying man, and with no glimmer of hope for Sierra Maria. As he was returning to the city along the cornice of the hill, he saw a man of imposing appearance sitting on a stone in the road next to a dead horse. The Marquis told the driver to stop, and only when the man stood did he recognize the licentiate Abrenuncio de Saparera Cao, the most notable and controversial physician in the city. Identical to the King of Clubs, he wore a broad-brimmed hat for the sun, riding boots, and the black cloak favored by educated libertines. His greeting to the Marquis was not at all usual. "Benedictus qui venit in nomine veritatis," he said. His horse had not survived the descent of the same slope it had ascended at a trot, and its heart had burst. Neptuno, the Marquis's coachman, attempted to remove the saddle from the animal. The owner stopped him. "What use do I have for a saddle if I have no one to saddle?" he said. "Leave it to rot along with him." The coachman had to help the doctor into the carriage because of his puerile corpulence, and the Marquis paid him the honor of having him sit on his right. Abrenuncio was thinking about his horse. "It is as if I had lost half my body," he sighed. "Nothing is easier to resolve than the death of a horse," said the Marquis. Abrenuncio became more animated. "This one was different," he said. "If I had the means, I would have him buried in holy ground." He looked at the Marquis to see his reaction and concluded, "He turned 100 in October." "No horse lives that long," said the Marquis. "I can prove it," said the doctor. On Tuesdays he offered his services at Amor de Dios Hospital, treating the lepers who suffered from other diseases. He had been an outstanding student of the physician Juan Méndez Nieto, another Portuguese Jew who had emigrated to the Caribbean because of the persecution in Spain, and had inherited his evil reputation for necromancy and a loose tongue, but no one cast doubt on his learning. His disputes with other physicians who would not forgive his incredible successes or uncommon methods were constant and bloody. He had invented a pill to be taken once a year, which enhanced one's health and lengthened one's life, but caused such mental derangement for the first 3 days that no one but the doctor had dared to swallow it. At one time he had been in the habit of playing the harp at the bedside of his patients in order to sedate them with certain music composed for the purpose. He did not practice surgery, which he always considered an inferior art fit only for charlatans and barbers, and his terrifying specialty was predicting the day and hour his patients would die. Both his good name and his bad, however, were based on the same circumstance. It was said, and no one ever disproved it, that he had resurrected a dead man. Despite his long experience, Abrenuncio felt pity for the rabies victim. "The human body is not made to endure all the years that one may live," he said. The Marquis did not miss a word of his exhaustive and colourful discourse, and spoke only when the doctor had nothing more to say. "What can be done for the poor man?" "Kill him," said Abrenuncio. The Marquis looked at him appalled. "At least that's what we would do if we were good Christians," the impassive doctor continued. "And never fear, Signor, there are more good Christians than one supposes." He was in reality referring to the poor Christians of every colour, in the slums and in the countryside, who had the courage to poison the food of their rabid kin in order to spare them a ghastly death. At the end of the previous century, an entire family had consumed poison soup because none of them had the heart to poison only a 5-year-old boy. "People believe that we physicians do not know that such things occur," Abrenuncio concluded. "That is not true, but we lack the moral authority to endorse them. What we do instead is what you've just seen. We commend the dying to St. Hubert and tie them to a pillar in order to prolong and intensify their suffering." "Is there no other recourse?" asked the Marquis. "After the initial outbreak of rabies, none at all," said the doctor. He mentioned frivolous treatises that considered it a curable disease responsive to various prescriptions: liverwort, cinnabar, musk, silver mercury, anagalis florae purpureo. "All rubbish," he said. "The fact is that some people contract rabies and others do not, and it is easy to say that if they do not, it was because of the medicines." He looked into the eyes of the Marquis to be certain he was still awake and concluded, "Why are you so interested?"
Out of pity," the Marquis lied.
Through the window he contemplated the sea grown drowsy in the ennui of 4 o'clock, and realized with a heavy heart that the swallows had returned. There was still no breeze. A group of children threw stones at a pelican gone astray on a muddy beach, and the Marquis followed the bird in its fugitive flight until it vanished among the brilliant domes of the fortified city. The carriage entered the walled precincts at the inland Media Luna Gate, and Abrenuncio guided the coachman through the bustling district of the artisans to his house. It was no easy task. Neptuno was over 70 years old and indecisive and short-sighted as well, and he was accustomed to having the horse move on its own through streets it knew better than he did. When at last they reached the house, Abrenuncio said goodbye at the door with a sentence from Horace.
"I am afraid I do not know Latin," the Marquis apologized.
"There's no reason you should," said Abrenuncio, and he said it in Latin, of course.
The Marquis was so impressed that his first act when he returned home was the most unusual of his life. He ordered Neptuno to collect the dead horse on San Lazaro Hill and bury it in holy ground, and early the next day to send Abrenuncio the best horse in his stable. After the ephemeral relief of antimony purges, Bernarda took as many as 3 consolatory enemas a day to extinguish the blaze in her belly, or sank into as many as 6 hot baths with perfumed soaps to soothe her nerves. By this time there was nothing left of the person she had been when she married, a woman who devised commercial ventures and put them into effect with the assurance of a soothsayer. So great was her success, until the ill-fated afternoon she met Judas Iscariote and was swept away by misfortune. She saw him for the first time inside a bullfighting corral erected at a fair, wrangling a fierce bull with his bare hands, almost naked and unprotected. He was so handsome and bold she could not forget him. days later she saw him again, dancing the kumbe at a carnival that she attended wearing a mask and disguised as a beggar, and surrounded by her slave women dressed as marquises, with necklaces and bracelets and earrings of gold and precious stones. Judas was in the center of a circle of onlookers, dancing with any woman who would pay him, and the authorities had to impose order to control the frantic yearning of his claimants. Bernarda asked him how much he cost. Judas replied as he danced, "Half a real." Bernarda took off her mask. "What I'm asking is how much you cost for the rest of your life," she said. Judas saw that with her mask removed she was not the beggar she had seemed. He let go of his partner and walked toward Bernarda with all the airs of a cabin boy to tell her his price. 500 gold pesos, he said. She measured him with the eye of a wary appraiser. He was enormous, with seal-colored skin, a rippling torso, narrow hips, graceful legs, and beautiful hands that belied his position in life. Bernarda estimated, "You're 2 meters tall." "And 3 centimeters, he said. Bernarda had him lower his head so that she could examine his teeth, and she found the ammoniac breath of his armpits unsettling. He had all his teeth, and they were healthy and straight. "Your master must be crazy if he thinks anyone's going to buy you for the price of a horse," said Bernarda. "I'm a free man, and I'm selling myself," he replied, and ended with a certain tone, "Señora." "Marquisa," she said. He made a courtier's bow that left her breathless, and she bought him for half of what he had aspired to. "Just for the pleasure of seeing him," as she said. In return, she respected both his condition as a free man and the time he spent wrangling his circus bull. She moved him into a room near her own, which had once belonged to the head groom, and from the first night, naked and with her door unbolted, she waited for him, certain he would come without being invited. But she had to wait 2 weeks and did not sleep in peace because of the fire in her body. The truth was that as soon as he learned who she was and saw the interior of the house, he re-established his slave's reserve. But when Bernarda had stopped waiting for him and slept in a nightgown and bolted the door, he came in through the window. The air in her room, rarefied by the ammoniac odor of his sweat, woke her. She heard the heavy breathing of a minotaur searching for her in the darkness. She felt the sultry heat of his body on top of her, his hands of prey grasping the neck of her nightgown and ripping it down the middle while his husky voice intoned in her ear, "Ho, ho." And from that night on, Bernarda knew there was nothing else she wanted to do for the rest of her life. She was mad about him. At night they would go to the dances in the slum districts, he dressed as a gentleman in a frock coat and round hat, which Bernarda bought to please him, and she in a variety of disguises at first, and then with her face unmasked. She showered him with the gold of chains, rings, bracelets, and studded his teeth with diamonds. She thought she would die when she learned he took every woman who crossed his path to bed. But in the end she settled for whatever was left over. It was during this time that Dominga de Adviento walked into Bernarda's bedroom at siesta, thinking she was at the sugar plantation, and found the two of them naked, making love on the floor. The slave woman stood there with her hand on the latch, more confused than surprised.
"Don't just stand there like a corpse," Bernarda shouted. "Either get out or get down here with us."
Dominga de Adviento left with a slam of the door that sounded to Bernarda like a slap in the face. That night she summoned her and threatened the most atrocious punishments if she said anything about what she had seen. "Don't worry, white lady," said the slave. "You can forbid whatever you like and I'll obey." And she concluded, "The trouble is you can't forbid what I think." If the Marquis did know anything, he was very good at pretending not to. After all, Sierva Maria was the only thing he still had in common with his wife, and he did not think of the girl as his daughter, but as hers alone. And Bernarda did not think of the girl at all. She had put her so far out of her mind that when she returned from one of her extended stays at the sugar plantation, Bernarda mistook her for someone else because she had grown and changed so much. She called for her, examined her, questioned her about her life, but could not get her to say a single word. "You're just like your father," she said to her. "A freak." Their attitudes had not changed on the day the Marquis returned from the Amor de Dios hospital and announced to Bernarda his resolve to take up the reins of the household with a warlike hand. There was something frenetic in his urgency that left Bernarda speechless. His first action was to return to the girl the bedroom that had belonged to her grandmother, the Marquisa, and that had been hers until Bernarda sent her to sleep with the slaves. Beneath the dust, its former splendor was still intact. The imperial bed that the servants thought was gold because of the brilliance of its copper, the mosquito netting made of bridal tulle, the rich hangings of passementerie, the alabaster washstand and numerous bottles of perfumes and cosmetics lined in martial order on the dressing table, the portable chamber pot, the porcelain spittoon and vomitory, the entire illusory world that the old woman, crippled by rheumatism, had dreamed for the daughter she never had and the granddaughter she never saw. While the slave women resurrected the bedroom, the Marquis went about imposing his will on the house. He drove away the slaves dozing in the shade of the arcades and threatened beatings and slaves' prison for any who ever again relieved themselves in the corners or gambled in the rooms that had been closed off. These were not new decrees. They had been followed with far greater rigor when Bernarda gave the orders and Dominga de Adviento carried them out, and the Marquis took public delight in his historic declaration. "In my house I do not say, I obey." But when Bernarda succumbed to the quicksands of cacao and Dominga de Adviento died, the slaves slipped back into the house with great stealth. First the women with their children to help in small tasks, and then the men without work, searching for the coolness of the corridors. Terrified by the spectre of ruin, Bernarda ordered them to earn their keep by begging in the streets. In one of her crises, she decided to free them all except for two or three house servants, but the Marquis opposed the idea with an illogical argument. "If they are going to die of hunger, it is better for them to die here and not among strangers." He did not adhere to these easy formulas when Sierva Maria was bitten by the dog. He granted certain powers to the slave who seemed to have the greatest authority and be the most trustworthy, and gave him instructions so harsh they shocked even Bernarda. Just after dark, when the house was in order for the first time since the death of Dominga de Adviento, he found Sierva Maria in the slave shack along with half a dozen young black women who were sleeping in hammocks crisscrossed at different levels. He woke them all to announce the rules of the new regime. "From this day forward, the girl lives in the house," he said, "and let it be known here and throughout the kingdom. She has only one family, and that family is white." The girl resisted when he tried to carry her in his arms to the bedroom, and he had to make her understand that a masculine order governed the world.